13.
I can tell what happened at the council house, as Auric and Peractimo told us afterwards. The troop of priests surrounding Idor forced their way forward through the crowd in Galva Street. Auric and Per managed to keep directly behind them. When they came to the council square, the soldiers guarding it shouted, "Let the Gond Idor pass!" and began to open the way for the troop of priests. But Idor and his red hats rode straight past, gaining speed as the crowd thinned out. Auric thought they were making for the Isma Bridge to escape from the city. But they were circling round the back of the council house to get to the entrance door on the far side, above the Alds' barracks. Soldiers guarded the 4-foot-high stone wall that marked off the back court. At Idor's shouted command, they opened the gate, and the troop of priests galloped in. But with them came a mob of citizens, who had joined Auric and Per following the priests past the entrance to the square. Soldiers attacked the citizens as they came pushing in the open gate and swarming over the wall, and citizens mobbed the soldiers. Idor and his red hats broke through the confusion, leapt off their horses, and made straight for the back door of the council house. Auric and Per kept right behind them through the melee. "The tail of the comet," Auric said. Before they knew what was happening, they were inside the council house, still on the heels of Idor and the priests, who were so intent on getting where they were going that they paid no attention to their pursuers. They all raced through a high hallway and down a flight of stairs. At the foot of the stairs was a basement corridor dimly lit by small windows high in the wall at ground level. Where this corridor opened into a large, low guardroom, the priests and Idor halted, shouting orders, at guards posted there. Or at an opposing force coming from the square? Auric said it was all shouting and confusion for a while, Alds yelling at Alds. He and Per had held back. Now they went forward cautiously to the doorway. The red-hatted priests and a troop of soldiers stood facing each other, the officers demanding to see the Gond Iaroth, the priests saying, "The Gond is dead. You cannot defile the rites of mourning." The priests had their backs against a door and stood firm. Idor was barely visible among them. He had cast off his golden hat and cloak somewhere. A priest advanced on the officers, formidable in his tall red hat and robes, his arms raised, shouting that if they did not disperse, he would curse them in the name of Ath. The soldiers drew back from him, cowed. Then, all at once, Auric strode straight at the priest, shouting, "Iaroth is alive! He is alive in that room! The oracle has spoken! Open the door of the prison, priests." Or so Per reported his words. Auric himself recalled only shouting out that Iaroth was not dead, and then the officers shouting, "Open the door! Open the door!" And then, he told us, "I ducked back out of it, for swords and daggers flashed out on both sides, the soldiers attacking the priests who defended the door, driving them away and down the farther corridor. An officer sprang forward and unbolted and flung open the door. The room beyond was black, unlighted. In the glimmer of lantern light in the doorway, a wraith appeared, a white figure out of the darkness. She wore the striped gown of an Ald slave, torn and streaked with filth and blood. Her face was bruised, one eye swollen shut, and her scalp covered with blackened, clotted blood where her hair had been torn out by handfuls. She gripped a broken stake in her hand. She stood there, Auric said, like a candle flame, luminous, trembling. Then she saw the man who stood beside Auric, Peractimo, and her face slowly changed. "Cousin," she said. "Lady Tyrio," Per said. "We're here to set the Gond Iaroth free." "Come in, then," she said. Auric said she spoke as gently and civilly as if she were welcoming guests into her home. The struggle in the corridor had intensified and then quieted. One of the soldiers brought in a lantern from the guardroom, and light and shadow leapt round the officers as they entered the prison chamber. Per and Auric followed them. It was a large, low room, earth-floored, with a foul, damp, heavy smell. Iaroth lay on a long chest or table, his arms and legs chained. His hair and clothing were blackened and half burnt away, and his legs and feet were bloody and crusted with burns. He reared up his head and said in a voice like a wire brush on brass, "Let me loose!" While his officers were busy getting the chains off him, he saw Auric and stared.
"Maker, how did you get here?"
"Following your son," Auric said. At that, Iarath glared round and wheezed out in his smoke-ruined voice,
"Where is he? Where is he?"
Auric, Pear, and the officers looked round, ran back to the guardroom. Four priests were being held there by soldiers. The rest were gone, Idor with them.
"My lord Gond," said one of the officers, "we'll find him. But if now, if you'd show yourself to the troops, my lord, they believe you're dead."
"Hurry up, then," Iarath growled.
As soon as they freed his arms, he reached out and caught the hand of the woman who stood silent beside him. When they got his legs free, he tried to stand up, but his burnt feet would not bear his weight. He cursed and sat back down abruptly, still gripping Tyrio Octomo's hand. The officers grouped round to carry him in a chair hold.
"With her,"
he said, gesturing impatiently.
"With them,"
gesturing at Auric and Pear. So the whole group stayed together as they went up the stairs to the high gallery that encircles the council chamber, and along it to the front of the great building, through its anteroom. They came out into blazing sunlight under the columns of the portico, on the speaker's terrace that looks out over the council square. The whole vast expanse of the square was a mass of people, and more still were pushing into it from every entrance, a greater number of people than Auric had ever seen, the citizens outnumbering the Ald forces by thousands. When Idor, the man they thought their new lord and general, had ridden on past the entrance from Council Way with no signal to them, the bewildered soldiers began to heed the growing rumor that the Gond Iarath was alive. Confused, divided in allegiance, some turning on others as traitors to Iarath or to Idor, they had broken ranks. Citizens had pushed into the square, armed with whatever they had. Before real fighting began, realizing how outnumbered they were, the officers quickly rallied the soldiers and pulled them together out of the crowd. Most of the Alds now stood on the steps of the council house and the pavement in front of it. In their blue cloaks they formed a solid half-circle facing the Ansul crowd, their swords bared, not threatening attack directly, but not yielding. The crowd, though tumultuous, kept back, leaving a ragged no-man's land between their front ranks and the soldiers. "There was an awful stink of burning," Auric told us. "Vile, hard to breathe. The air was full of dust, fine black dust, hanging there. The ash and cinders the crowd had trodden and trampled and kicked into the air. And I saw strange things sticking up out of that royal and press of people. It looked like the prow of a wrecked ship. I realized at last it was part of the frame of the great tent, with burnt canvas clinging to it. And there were whirlpools in the sea of people, places where men who'd been killed or wounded in the rush into the square were lying. Well, some people still pressed on past them, and others stopped to protect them. And the noise! I didn't know human beings could make a noise like that. It was terrifying. It never ceased. A kind of huge howling." He thought he could not force himself to go forward and stand facing that mob. His head swam with panic. The officers he was with were also clearly frightened and uncertain, but they carried their Gond forward staunchly, and they shouted out, "The Gond Iarath! He lives!" The soldiers below turned, stared up, saw him, and began to shout, "He lives!" Iarath was saying irritably to the men carrying him, "Put me down!" And they finally obeyed. He got a firm grip on the arm of one of them with one hand, and on Tyrio's shoulder with the other. He managed to take a step forward, grimacing with pain, and to stand there,
facing the crowd.
The roar of his soldiers' salute dominated the bellowing of the crowd for a while, but soon the terrible noise was growing again, drowning the shouts of "He lives" in shouts of "Death to the tyrant! Death to the Alds!"
Iorath raised his hand. The authority of that ragged, fire-scarred, shaky figure brought silence, and he spoke.
"Soldiers of Asudar! Citizens of Ansul!"
But his smoke-horsened voice did not carry. They could not hear him. One of the officers stepped forward, but Iorath ordered him back.
"Him! Him!" he said,
gesturing Auric forward.
"They'll listen to him! Talk to them, Maker! Quiet them down!"
The crowd saw Auric then, and a roar went up from them. They shouted, "Lero! Lero!" and "Liberty!" Amid that tumult, Auric said to Iorath,
"If I speak to them, I speak for them."
The Gaunt nodded impatiently. So Auric raised his hand for silence, and a rumbling, muttering silence spread out through the huge mob. He told us that he'd had no idea what he would say from one word to the next, and couldn't remember what he said. Others remembered well, and wrote down his words later.
"People of Ansul, we have seen the water of the dead fountain run. We have heard the voice that was silent speak. The oracle bade us set free. And so we have done this day. We have set free the master. We have set free the slave. Let the men of Asudar know they have no slaves. Let the people of Ansul know they have no masters. Let the Alds keep peace, and Ansul will keep peace with them. Let them sue for alliance, and we will grant them alliance. In living token of that peace and that alliance, hear Tyrio Octomo, citizen of Ansul, wife of the Gond Iorath."
If the Gond was taken aback, it didn't show on his battered sooty face. He stood there, not able to do much more than keep standing, holding on to Tyrio while she spoke. Her voice was clear and valiant, but very frail, and all the crowd in the square went silent to hear her. Though there was still a hoarse, continual tumult of noise from all the nearby streets.
"May the gods of Ansul be blessed again, who will bless us with peace," she said. "This is our city. Let us hold it as we always held it, lawfully. Let us be a free people once again. Luck and Lero and all our gods be with us."
The deep chant of "Lero, Lero"
rose up from the crowd, following on her words. Then a man broke forward from the crowd, shouting out,
"Give us our city! Give us back our council house!"
Those who were there said that was the most dangerous moment of all. If the crowd had simply pressed forward in its huge, irresistible force to occupy the council house, and had met the army standing firm, they would have fought, and Ald soldiers fight to the death. It was Iorath who prevented a slaughter. Rasping out orders to his officers, who shouted them full voice and relayed them by trumpet calls, rallying the soldiers and shifting the whole mass of them rapidly over from the council house steps to the area east of it, clearing the steps for the wild crowd who had begun to flood up and surge into the building. It was the soldiers' discipline, Auric said, that saved them, and the thousands of citizens who would have died in such a battle. The Gond's order had been, "Down arms," and after that, not one soldier raised his sword. Even when shoved, struck, or pushed aside by exultant, vengeful civilians. To escape the onrush of the mob, Auric and Pear stayed with a knot of officers who chair-lifted Iorath again, and ran with him to the east end of the terrace and down the side steps to join the ranks that were reforming there. Tyrio, Pear, and Auric followed them. A litter was fetched for the Gond, When they got him settled, he promptly summoned Auric.
"Well said, Maker,"
he said, half audible, with a kind of grim salute.
"But I have no authority to make an alliance with Ansul."
"Best obtain it, my lord," said Tyrio Octomo in her silvery voice. The old Gaunt looked up at her. Evidently he saw her bruises, her puffed eye, her torn hair and blood-clotted scalp clearly for the first time. He sat up staring, glaring, shouting in a whisper,
The damned traitor! Oth strike him dead! Where is he?"
The officers looked at one another.
"Find him!"
wheezed the Gond, and began to cough. Tyrio Octomo knelt beside the litter and put her hand on his.
"Ieroth, you must be quiet a while," she said.
He laughed through his coughing and gripped her hand. Looking up at Auric, he said,
"Married us, did you?"
It seemed a long time before Auric came back to us at Galvamond. Yet it was still early afternoon of that day that had already been as long as a year. The Wayloid had come in at my urging for some food and a brief rest, but then he returned to the reception hall that ran along the front of the house, called the High Gallery. It had never been used in my lifetime, and had no furnishings. Its doors, the wide front doors of Galvamond, stood open now. He asked for chairs and benches to be brought, and there were plenty of willing hands to bring them, not only from other rooms, but from houses nearby. He sat down there and made himself available to all who came. And they came, dozens of people, hundreds. They came to see the Oracle Fountain run, and to hear those who had been there tell how the Oracle had spoken and what it had said. That was when I first learned that not all had heard the same words, or that as the words were repeated, they were changed, and changed again. People came to see the Waylord, Galva the Reader, to greet him, to take counsel with him. Many who came were working men and women. Others were, or had been, merchants, magistrates, mayors of wards of the city, and members of the council. They were all poor, because we were all poor. You couldn't tell shoemakers from shipmasters by their clothes. Some of the working people came in only to bless the gods of the house and greet the reader of the oracle with awed and joyful respect and be gone again. But others stayed, along with the mayors and councillors, the merchants and members of great households, to sit and talk about what was happening and air their opinions on what could and should be done. So I first saw what it was to be a citizen, and what it was to be a waylord, too. I stayed with him to wait on his needs, and because he asked me to be there. I found it difficult because people looked at me with awe and fear. Some of them made the gesture of worship to me. I felt utterly false and foolish, and had no idea what to say to anybody. But they had the Waylord to talk to, and fortunately I had to go to the kitchen pretty often to give a hand to Ista, who was almost crazy with excitement and anxiety. The house was full again at last. "It's like the old days," she said over and over, "the good days." But she had no food to offer the guests of the house. "I can't even offer them water," she said, tears of rage springing into her eyes. "I haven't got enough drinking cups."
"Borrow them," said Bomi.
"No, no,"
Ista said, offended at the thought. But I said, "Why not?" And Bomi darted off to extort drinking cups from neighbors. I went back to the reception hall and spoke to Anulo Kam, the wife of Sulsem Kam, who had come last night, a year ago, and had returned now with his wife and son to sit and talk with the Waylord and the others. I explained our need to her, and very soon a couple of boys from Kamund brought us a 50 heavy glass goblets, telling Ista, as they had been bidden,
"A gift from our house to the blessed House of the Fountain."
It was hard for Ista to take offense at that, though she scowled. From then on, she kept Bomi and Sosta frantic, fetching water for every guest and taking back and washing out the goblets. She still wanted to offer food, of course, to everyone, but I did not see my way to begging on that scale. I said to her that the people came to talk, not eat. She scowled again, bit her lip, and turned away. I realized then that I had given her an order, and she had taken it. I went to her and put my arms round her. She hadn't cuffed me for years, but she never had been one for hugs. "Bye, Mother," I said. "Don't fret. Be happy with the spirits and shadows of our house. Our guests want nothing more than the water of the Oracle Fountain."
"Ah, Mimir, I don't know what to think," she said,
getting loose from me with a hasty pat on my shoulder. None of us knew what to think that day. When Auric came back at last, he was the comet, not the tail. A stream of people followed him from the council square. He was the hero of the city. He stopped at the Oracle Fountain and looked up at the ceaseless silver jet of water with the same laughing amazement I had seen on so many faces. Gry came to meet him there. Shatar was shut away in the master's rooms, where, Gry had told me, she was sulking and tearing strips out of the poor mangy old carpet. Auric and Gry held each other for a long time before they went up the steps and into the reception hall. Everybody crowded after them. Once he had greeted the Waylord, Auric had to tell the whole story that I've just written of the morning's events at the council house. Some of it we already knew from people who had been back and forth from Galvamond and the square. But the pursuit of Idor and the priests to the prison chamber and the finding of Ioroth and Tyrio was news to us, as was the disappearance of Idor. If Auric couldn't tell us what he had said to the crowd, there were plenty of people who could.
He said, "Let them beg for alliance, and we'll grant them alliance," one old man shouted out. "By the harrow of Sampa, let 'em beg. Let 'em crawl, and we'll give or not give in our own good time."
That was the mood of the city that day. Fiercely joyous, belligerent, barely restrained from vengeance. Ioroth had ordered his soldiers to keep off the streets and stay within the barracks area south and east of the council house, which they surrounded with a cordon of guards. Wanting access to the council stables where their horses and some of their men were, the soldiers tried to cordon off a passage between the barracks and the stables. But the crowd in the square got ugly. Stones were thrown, and the Gond ordered his men to stay where they were, whether in the barracks or the stable yards. The Alds were taking care to offer no provocation and show no fear. Their position could too easily become, perhaps already was, a state of siege. Once the habit of fear was broken, the citizens would realize that the conquerors who had mastered them for so long were dependent on them for supplies, and were, however formidable and well-armed, vastly outnumbered. If the restraint Ioroth imposed on his men was mistaken for weakness, for unwillingness to fight, there could yet be a massacre. They talked about that in the reception hall, and they talked about Desak and his group, what their plan had been and how it had gone wrong. The man who had taken refuge with us, Caderantro, was there, and his story was confirmed and enlarged by others. The arsonists were Ansul's slaves, used as servants and sweepers by Ald courtiers. The idea of burning the great tent had come from one of them to begin with. They had secretly admitted to the tent other conspirators dressed as slaves, but armed, and with them had prepared so that fires would start up in several places at once, engulfing the tent in flame, while Desak's men, rushing into the square from two directions, would attack the soldiers on guard. All that was to take place at the sunset ceremony, so that Idor and Ioroth and many officers and courtiers would be in the tent when the fire broke out. But because Idor wanted to disturb Auric's recitation, the priests began the ceremony earlier than planned, and so the time of the assault had to be changed, and word of the change didn't get to all the conspirators. The ceremony was already ending when the fires were set. Ioroth came late and was still there praying, but Idor and the chief priests had just left the tent. The fire spread with terrible quickness, and all of Desak's people who were there attacked. But the soldiers were quick to rally, and seemed fearless of the fire,
the promised embrace of their burning god. In the fighting and the smoke and confusion, evidently only Idor and the priests saw Iorath stagger free of the flames. They seized and carried him to the council house, while the soldiers drove the conspirators, those who tried to flee and those who tried to attack, into the furnace of the fire to be burned alive. Desak was one of them. I could only think of that black, foul dust of ash and cinder Auric had told us of, kicked up by the feet of the crowds. The people hearing the story were silent for a while before they began to talk again.
"So Idor saw his chance," one man said, "with the old Gond as good as dead."
"Why did he put him in prison? Why not finish him off?"
"It's his father, after all. What's that to an Ald?"
I thought of Sima, how proud he was of his father, even of his father's horse.
"He was going to get his own back on the old man. 17 years he's been waiting. And the old man's Ansul mistress. Torture them for the pleasure of it."
That brought a silence. People glanced uneasily at the Wailord. "So where's he got to, that one with his red hats?" a woman asked. People hated the Ald priests worse than they hated the soldiers. "I say they'll find him hiding. They'd never get through the streets alive, that lot." She was right. We heard about it later that day, as news was constantly brought down the street to us by dusty, excited, exhausted people coming from the square. The citizens swarming through the council house, retaking it for the city, throwing out all the goods and furniture of the Ald courtiers and officers who had used it for their quarters, came on Idor and three priests hiding in a tiny attic room in the base of the dome. They were taken down and locked in the basement room, the torture chamber, where Iorath and Tirio had been locked for a night, where Sultar Galva had been locked for a year. That news relieved our hearts. We had suffered much from Idor's belief that he had been divinely sent to drive out demons and destroy evil, and we all felt now that, with him imprisoned, disgraced, the power of that belief was broken. We had to deal with an enemy still, but a human enemy, not a demented god. And it was a relief also to know that the wild crowd going through the council house hadn't torn the priests to pieces when they found them, but had locked them away to wait for some kind of justice, whether ours or the Ald's. "We may treat Idor better than his father would," said Sulsem Kam. "I doubt he'd be gentle with him," Auric said wryly. "No gentler than your lady and her lion," said Per Octimo, who had rejoined Auric here, and helped him retell their exploits and adventures to newcomers wanting to hear it all over again all afternoon. "That was the beginning of the end of Idor, when he flinched and drew back in front of all the crowd. Where is your lion, Lady Gry? She should be here to be praised." "She's in a very bad temper," Gry said. "It's her fasting day, and I've had to keep her indoors. I'm afraid she's eaten part of the carpet." "Give her a feast, not a fast," said Per, and people laughed and called for the lion, the only Ald on our side. So Gry went and fetched Shatar, who was indeed in a sullen mood. She had not appreciated the swimming and boating of the night before, or the crowd scenes of the morning. She sensed the continuing tension in the city, and like all cats, she detested uproar, excitement, change. She paced into the reception hall with a sing-song snarling "wah, wah, wah," and a yellow glare. Everyone made her plenty of room. Gry led her up to the Wailord and had her do her stretching bow, and people laughed again and praised her. They asked for her to do her obeisance again, for Auric, for Per, for a little boy of 3 who was there with his parents. And so Shatar got a good many treats and began to cheer up. It was evening. The big room was growing shadowy. Ista, along with the Alba, Tirio's companion who had brought us such important word at daybreak, came with lighted lamps. Ista had told me that that was always the signal for guests to leave in the old days. And as if the ways and customs of our people had been given back to us today,
All the visitors rose, one after another, and took their leave of the Waylord. They spoke to Auric and Gry and to me, and as they passed through the door, they spoke to the souls and shadows of the house. As they passed the fountain, leaping up into the evening air, they blessed the Lord of the Springs and Waters, and as they crossed the sillstone, they bent down to touch it.